Hello, I'm Will Shires, and this is Talking Trucks. Every year, freelance journalist and truck aficionado Bob Beach chooses a classic truck to drive for Commercial Motor's bumper Christmas issue. And this year, it's a stunning AEC Mercury. In this episode, I join him in the cab of the Mercury when he tells me about the truck and why it all went wrong for the British truck industry. So, Bob, thank you for joining us. What are we sitting in, and why have you chosen this for the Christmas Commercial Motor?
Well, Will, it's like everything in life. You get to a certain point in time and age, and you look back. And luckily, I've been given a sort of free rein to choose what I want up to a point. I decided that I'd be able to go and look for an AEC Mercury, like the first truck I drove for my dad when I was 21, which was, by my reckoning, about 45 and a half years ago. And luckily, we found this one with Andrew Leonard down in Honiton in Devon. It's been beautifully restored, and it's pretty much near enough identical the first one I drove. It's, for the uninitiated, AEC was a British manufacturer that became part of British Leyland, based in West London, builders of London's buses originally, and yep. they built a wide range of vehicles, big export following, strong following with operators of all sizes. I suppose the best way to describe it, they were deadly rivals between AEC and Leyland, and they amalgamated and came together. It would be the equivalent, I suppose, of Volvo and Scania merging, like, you know? And it was never a really happy marriage, but the Mercury was their base tract unit. It was they built it as a 4x2, at those days, 16-ton rigid, and as a tract unit for 25, 26-ton gross, depending on a particular specification. The one I drove was a 1972 one. I was given it by my father as some sort of gift to drive when it was 5 years of age, and most people would see it as being a kind of fairly well-worn vehicle in those days. But when you're young and kind of keen, it was something that, like, you know, your first truck.
Yeah.
So we found this one, and here we are today, sat in it, and what do you term an ergomatic, because that was the design of the Leyland Group cab, tilt cab. This particular one is a 1974 example. Towards the latter end of production, they went out of production in 78-79, so it was getting near, you know, the end of that sort of span.
Yeah. Well, the ergomatic cab actually limped all the way into the 80s, I think, didn't it?
It did, yeah. It did on the Bison and on the Buffalo and what have you. It originally came out in 64. AEC and Leyland amalgamated, or were taken over, or joined together at the hip in 62, and they had diverse cab ranges. AEC, prior to that, actually didn't make cabs. All of the cabs were built by outside bodybuilders. And you'd order the truck with like a floor and a scuttle, if you like, the front panel.
Yeah.
And then individual cab builders, be it Park Royal or Tillotson's, would build a cab, which seems absolutely bonkers nowadays, but that's the way it was. Whereas Leyland had their own range of cabs, the LAD cab and what have you, and that needed updating, so they sunk a lot of money into the research and development of the ergomatic cab. The idea was it was to give much better levels of comfort, much better levels of vision, better access, and as you can see, Will, it's got windows in every corner.
The visibility is incredible. I mean, you and I have just driven that DAF XD, and both of us praised that for visibility, but that's nothing compared with this.
No, yeah. Well, you've got, because the vehicle's relatively small, and a relatively small 8.25-litre engine, you've got the actual base of the cab is lower. You've got a large engine tunnel inside, obviously, but you've got windows all around you, and you've also got the ability that, if you like, you can make eye contact with other road users, be it cyclists or pedestrians, because you're actually at their, not much higher than being at their eye level. And rather than having a great big truck where you're struggling to look down, you're basically just looking straight out at them,
aren't
you?
I wonder how many direct vision stars this would score.
3 to 4, I guess. It'd need better mirrors but I wouldn't be at all surprised. I mean, I don't know what complex formula they use. And I wouldn't be at all surprised to see it basically get 3, and with better mirrors, or more modern mirrors, probably 4. And
yeah.
The other advantage, you've got like some really clever little bits of design. like, obviously everything is in front of you, like the next to the steering wheel. There's no adjustment of the steering wheel. It was a very simple process that in those days the driver adjusted to fit the truck. And whereas now, you know, we want everything to be able at a fingertip and what have you. But, like, you've got the dash in front of you. There's no tacho because it predates tacho. It would have had a tacho if it was in service in, like, after late 70s, early 80s. There's not even a rev counter in here. You've got this big bonnet to lean on in the middle, and all the switches, apart from the gear lever and the handbrake, are directly in front of you. So you don't have a great big fascia that's taking up half the depth of the windscreen. No. You can see the windscreen rubber all the way across the bottom, can't you, like, you know?
Speaking of clever features, these window winders, whatever you call them, are fantastic. It's just so simple, isn't it?
It's just a simple mechanical lever with a window regulator. It's got an internal friction in there that will hold the window at intermediate levels. But if you want to get the window down really quickly, just push the lever straight down, pull the lever back up again, and it kind of makes you wonder about electric systems where it's pouring with rain and you're sat there pressing the button anxiously as water's pouring into the cab, like, you know.
Yeah.
It is a very clever design.
Did they do a sleeper cab?
The factory... Originally, there was a design. There was part of the problem back in the early 60s, the legislation, the overall length legislation, went against having sleeper cabs because it would have made the vehicle over length as an Artic. Also, the culture was that drivers would go into overnight digs and accommodation and what have you. And there was an element of union opposition and what have you, and it was worded in relation to the law about taking rest away from the vehicle. But to be perfectly honest, a lot of people used to sleep in day cabs. And
how could you possibly sleep in it unless you're sitting upright?
If you're tired enough, you'll sleep anywhere, I suppose, is the answer. But the truth is, I used to sleep in one of these if I had to. And we could almost do a complete feature about the ingenuity that people used to sleep in various day cabs. Some people made folding bunks. I've even seen people with hammocks. The most normal way with an ergomatic cab, be it AEC, Leyland or Albion, was use a piece of board and put it on the window ledge over there so it spans across the passenger seat, and maybe use another piece of board or your bag to pack the other side up, and if you're really lucky, a decent piece of foam and stretch across there. But always be sure to lock the passenger door, because otherwise if someone opens the door, you'll be launched.
Of course.
Like being as many people say, it's like being buried at sea. And it's you know, people used to use rudimentary curtains or all sorts and that, and it sounds ridiculous to say so now, but that's what we used to do. And I suppose, you know, you make the best of the situation you're in, don't you, like, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, ironically, when I worked for my dad, we used to do general haulage, but we also moved caravans and mobile homes. And when you were on caravan work, the mantra was always, if possible, get loaded with a caravan or mobile home the night before, because as long as you've got a key, you'll then have a sleeper cab that makes a DAF XG Plus look small.
Yeah, you know? Fantastic.
And not the warmest of things to sleep in at night or whatever, but like you, at least you could stretch out, and that used to lead to all manner of kind of situations and what have you, and being sure to make sure you don't open the door and step straight out of the caravan door in the morning, like, to, you know, drop into a ditch somewhere. I can also remember, this sounds like antediluvian, but carrying mobile homes and two-section mobile homes and sleeping in one where it's obviously been split into two sections, and they just use plastic and battens to, like, fill in the open side, and kind of waking up like, and you feel like you're on a stage somewhere if it's daylight. God. But the truth is, how do you sleep in them? Pretty uncomfortably, you know. But in terms of sleep, to answer your original question, yes, there was a factory sleeper cab option. It wasn't listed, but in normal spec sheets and what have you. But it was a special option quite often for export markets. Leyland offered them, and there were a number of different layouts and that, single bunk layouts. You could have a slightly raised roof and even a folding passenger seat and what have you, or a reclining passenger seat. They were very rare. Also, some companies, particularly into the mid-70s, had conversions, sleeper cab conversions, people like locomotives and what have you. They'd extend the rear wall backwards and you'd have enough room for a single bunk and what have you. The problem is with the ergomatic cab, because the bonnet is so big, because the cab is a low-line mounted cab, it dominates the cab.
Mm.
But AEC, I mean, a number of your listeners, stroke readers, will have heard of the AEC V8 Mandata, which was a very promising project that they started in the mid to late 60s with a V8 engine that was going to offer, ultimately in turbocharged form, up to 350 brake horsepower or more. And it was in its early stages of development, and it was pushed into production. It was not really ready for production. They had problems with overheating, and they had problems with bearing problems, and the engine was really too restricted underneath the ergomatic cab. But the V8 cab actually had, it didn't have the great big engine tunnel. It just had a small, very, very minor hump in the middle, and okay, there was enough room for double seats as well, or you could actually walk across the cab. And some of those had sleeper cabs on them with raised roofs and two bunks, and they were quite good. They weren't bad at all, really. But again, because of the core mechanical problems with the engine and that, most people never ran them for long. And it probably was the single most instrumental factor in the demise of AEC. They had a number of revisions of the design of the V8 engine, but it kind of mortally wounded the company, and they ended up buying quite a lot of them back off customers. And
did they?
Yeah, and also because of the dynamics of British Leyland and the car division, and everything was running out of money because so much money was being taken for the truck operations to subsidise the car divisions, and AEC were just left to wither on the vine, which was a great shame because they had a very, very strong customer loyalty, a good dealer and service network. And if you go back into the 60s and early 70s, an operator with a fleet of AECs was generally someone who was quite a substantial operator in that part of the country. And again, there we are. It's a sad part of history, I suppose.
Now, you've just driven this one. Did it bring back good memories?
It's about 42 years since I last drove a Mercury. Yeah, I've driven a few AEC since then. Yes, it's very simple, basically. Key start with the button, make sure the engine stop is pushed down behind the seat, turn the key, press the button, and it fires up straight away. 6-speed constant mesh gearbox, you pull away in solo tracking at second or third. The clutch is quite abrupt on this particular one, but that's individual characteristics and adjustment, but you adapt and get used to it. The gears, obviously, there's no rev counter, so you've got to judge the engine revs by ear. They're fairly forgiving, particularly running around solo. Double the clutch, and also the gears are ever so slightly angled. They're not straight back and forth, and you've just got to sense where the gate is and not be positive, but just give it a little pause as you change gear, as you double the clutch. And also you realise how sloppy and lazy your driving has become. You've got to be more precise and a little bit more measured, and get into the right gear for the situation before you've got to that situation. All the things you should do properly, but modern vehicles make it so easy, particularly with automated gearboxes. Yep. We just sit and point them, don't we, really?
If I put a picture of this up on Instagram or Twitter now, there'll be comments. I know there'll be comments like, proper trucks, best of British, or wish I was driving one of these every day. You wouldn't, though, would you?
It's great. It's like Andrew Leonard, the owner, who's made a superb job of over 20 years of restoring it. And it's fantastic that people have the time, dedication and expense to do so. But they were becoming dated when they were in production. And with a failure to invest and go forward, by the time they were coming out of service, they were very dated. And they're noisy. The ride is very harsh without a load on it. The cab is cramped. It's less than good, if you've got to sleep in the damn thing, which you shouldn't realistically have been doing.
I bet it gets incredibly hot in here as well, with all this glass and this engine just next to us.
Hot weather, they get very warm. In the cold weather, there's only a rudimentary heater outlet. It depends, and also on a lot of older trucks in those days, the heater matrices would tend to kind of get blocked, so they wouldn't circulate any hot air properly. The thermostats wouldn't allow the engine to run warm, keep warm enough in cold weather, and they could be damn cold to drive, literally you're freezing. You'd be wearing two pairs of socks and maybe overalls over the top of your normal clothes, and you'd get out to warm up, because as simple as that. And unless people have experienced it, and there are certain kind of how can I put it, hardy individuals who enjoy that on a long-term basis. But the truth is, when the Continental vehicles came along with better heaters, better soundproofing and what have you, once you've driven one regularly, very few people wanted to go back.
Yeah.
And judging things by the standards of today, just on the way something looks, is a very, how can I put it, it's not a very accurate way of portraying something. You've got to go and drive it. And also, I mean, this Mercury, she's AC 505 engine, 152 brake horsepower, at 25 ton gross, it's barely 6 brake horsepower per ton. With 6 gears, you are driving it relatively hard all the time to get anywhere loaded. You'd be probably slower on a lot of hills than a modern day 150 ton low loader. So, you know, to say that you could use it in modern conditions and that is, no, it's, you know, it's like everything. I always say it's like meeting someone from 30-odd years ago. They're not quite the way you imagine them to be, because everything happens in your time or what have you, slightly changes your perception.
Yeah.
It's great to come and drive it and what have you, and I'm, you know, really grateful. And, yeah, the years roll away. But do I want to go and drive one every day? No, thank you.
If you did have to drive a mid-70s truck every day, what would you choose? Would it be something Swedish?
You've got to think in terms of those terms, because they led the way. Not to have this, you know, kind of Volvo Scania is best kind of bias, because that's arrant nonsense. And other manufacturers like DAF and that were improving their products dramatically. But the Swedes, where they stole a march, if you think about it. Sweden is a very big country. It's got a very small population in relation to its size. It's got a pretty tough winters. So that means if you've got someone to go and drive a truck, you want them to go and drive a truck every day, because there isn't a spare driver around the next corner. So if you make it comfortable, you make it enjoyable, you give it really good heating and comfort, the chances are that people will want to drive it. And this is the kind of fundamental problem with the kind of British trucks in the 70s. They took so long to catch up in terms of driver comfort, and it was almost as if labour and an alternative driver was too easy to find. It created a situation where operators would only want to buy the most basic of vehicles, and British manufacturers tended until they realised what was going on, build those type of vehicles, which were good, honest workhorses. But once you've driven, say, like an F88 Volvo with a decent heater and a radio,
yeah,
you weren't going to go back. And by the time the penny dropped, as I say, with the manufacturers, it was too late. And, you know, yeah, the tragedy with the AEC, because of the British Leyland and all of the attendant problems, is they were starved of investment. And the people there, they were good engineers. They knew what they had to do, but they didn't have the means of doing it. So you come back to the kind of Swedish argument. Whilst, you know, Volvos and Scanias weren't perfect, and engine life and that could be relatively, you know, sort of short compared to things like a Cummins or a Gardner, but people wanted to use them. And the best vehicles that people do the best job with are the ones that they want to use. So you've got to point in that direction, you know. As the British fought back with the likes of Sedan Atkinson and ERF and that, they made some good trucks, some very good trucks. Leyland introduced the T-45 road train and cruiser and what have you and that. But they were playing catch-up. And once you're in a catch-up mode in a marketplace, it's very, very difficult. And a lot of operators, if you think about it, well, the sort of 50-odd years now, since nearly 60 years, since the kind of 60s. 1968, we had the Transport Act under the Labour government, which introduced plating and testing. It introduced, ultimately, the tachograph. It introduced heavy goods vehicle licensing.
Yeah.
It came hand in hand with the developments as well of new roads, motorways, etc., etc. But the most fundamental change was the introduction of O licensing, which, compared to the old A, B, and C license system, which was very restrictive, it meant that operators had control of their business and control of their work. the introduction of the old license system meant that many, many people came into the industry, for quite a lot from outside. And I've always felt that what happened is, before that, transport was a relatively closed shop, and buying vehicles to a certain extent was a bit of a closed shop, because you need an A license, B license, or whatever, to be able to apply for hire and reward transport. And it meant that truck manufacturers and their dealers were used to dealing with the same people. If you imagine the scenario of a new O license holder in 1969, 1970, would have kind of probably thought, oh, local successful hauler runs Atkinson's with Gardner engines or whatever, I'll go and see about buying one of those. So you go to your local dealer, and as they were on something like 2 years delivery, if you weren't part of the kind of favoured regular customer routine, you probably thought, well, oh, so you went to find, can I buy one? You find you can't buy one. And just say, for the sake of argument, there was a Volvo dealer in town, or a DAF dealer, and you went to them and you said, yeah, you can have an F86 or an F88 or be it a 2200 DAF or whatever, and you can have it in a month. You did so.
Of course you
and,
did.
And what happened is you had a core of people who developed who weren't natural buyers of the traditional British trucks, because their original, in some cases, their original experience was a negative one, wasn't it? And like whole sectors of the market went away from quite a lot of the kind of British truck manufacturers. And by the time they were in the business of improving their products in from driver appeal and what have you, some of these people who had bought their second and third imported truck. And if the dealer was a good dealer and manufacturer supported it, they didn't have the reason to change. And, you know, we have endless online debates, I see, and what have you. People talk about the demise of the transport, of the British truck manufacturing industry. And probably the most simple way of explaining it is that the market decided. And when the market decides, there is no force on this planet that can alter it. And the marketplace decided in greater numbers every year of what type of trucks they wanted to buy. And if they aren't the trucks you make as a manufacturer, the inevitable will happen.
Of course it will.
And it's very sad, and I take no delight in recounting this, but that and by the kind of mid-80s, the British manufacturers were making trucks with in some cases the equal or better. But if you're, as a potential customer, your original experience was a negative, you didn't look any further, did you?
No, that's right.
You know, and like if you look at the, as manufacturers, as, you know, the DAFs of this world and the Volvos and Scanias, the Mercedes and MANs, as their business grew, as they exported to more and more markets, they became larger companies. They had the resources to invest in R&D, didn't they?
Yeah.
Through amalgamation. And as our export markets in traditional markets for British trucks, like in Australia and other previous Commonwealth countries, they shrank. We were on the back foot when it came to exporting into Europe because we didn't have the right trucks.
No.
So as their potential market shrank, the other manufacturers became bigger, stronger, financially more successful, with a wider customer base and a wider potential customer base to chase after. And it was a long and lingering kind of death. And it will forever be a tragedy. But if you look back to the days with this AEC we're sat in, AEC, with the right leadership, the right investment, and the right political will in the country, could have been Volvo or Scania.
Yeah, it's sad, isn't it? You were saying then about not having the volumes, but you've got the likes of the ERF EC. That was a bloody good truck, wasn't it? And they didn't have the money behind them. They didn't have the volumes. How were they able to produce that? You'd agree that's...
Clever engineering and the support from the driveline suppliers of Cummins and what have you and that. And, yeah, when I drove an EC for a couple of... back a year or two ago, a good friend of mine's got a whole fleet of VRFs. And you walk around it and you look at it and you think, this is a well-designed truck. You know, it's got a Cummins M11 in it, it's got a twin splitter, full cab suspension, rear air suspension. The truth is, some of the individuals involved in ERF had spent time with some of the European manufacturers and also in North America, and they brought those modern methods and those modern designs, and they were able to encapsulated in probably one of the best British trucks ever built, I would say, an ERFEC. It drives well, it handles well, it's got a decent cab by the standards of the mid-90s or whatever. But once again, events, I suppose, events overtook them, be it financial events, world events, the increasingly onerous demands of emission regulations. You need to sell a lot of trucks and you need to sell a lot of engines to invest. Once we got to Euro 3, realistically, it was almost impossible for the smaller manufacturers to find an engine supplier that was prepared to make the investment for what could be, I don't know, a total market of 5,000 or 6,000 engines a year. You know, it's really strange. You look at the figures. I see the other day when we were on that DAF press trip, and they said they've taken 50,000 orders for XFs and XGs and XG pluses. And then you look at the relative figures, and like you kind of, that is just for one sector of their product range. I was looking some figures up the other day, Volvo F88s and F89s, and like you think, how many did they sell? You would have thought, I don't know, 300,000-400,000. In total, it was something like about just over 100,000.
Is that right?
Yeah, and you realise how the manufacturers have grown massively, haven't they? You know, truck manufacturer now is on a worldwide platform. You look at DAF, you know, they use the Packard driveline, which is the DAF-based engine and what have you, in every market they're involved in the world, in different brands. And that means that you're not building 5,000-10,000 engines, you're building 200,000 engines. And obviously the unit cost comes down dramatically in the way of clawing back your development costs and what have you, and that. And you realise how the world has changed, hasn't it, massively. And again, I suppose Britain, in so many of our industries, because of lack of foresight, lack of investment, maybe lack of political will, it's created a scenario where we've kind of missed the boat, haven't we?
Yeah, we have.
You know, and the sad thing is, a lot of our original technology, our engine technology, I mean, AECs used to sell engines, loose engines and that, to manufacturers throughout the world. They sell complete trucks. French manufacturers like Willem, they would use AEC engines. They would even license their engine technology, as did Leyland. Leyland were an early supplier of engines to DAF when they first started making trucks.
That's right.
And licensed their engine designs throughout the world. But I suppose what happened is you're not going to be giving money to someone else when you could develop your own engine and maybe take the ideas from the design you've got in front of you. And as your business expands, you invest in your own designs, don't you? We sort of sat back and thought, well, they'll keep buying off us because it doesn't work like that, does it? You know,
of course it doesn't.
You know, and like you to use the example with the RF. I mean, the RF got in problems of its own making or whatever. I think probably their range became a bit too complex and a bit too diverse as they tried to cover so many niches, and it became a rather kind of complex mishmash of cabs.
Of course, that Steyr cab, didn't they? The EP,
right.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. And also the Turkish, they've imported the Turkish.
That was the EP, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, and the ES was the Steyr cab.
That's right.
And then you had the MAN ECT, wasn't it? And the ECX was the last proper fiberglass cab DRF. I drove one of those, you know, an unusual 80-ton heavy haulage tractor unit with an 18-speed full of Road Ranger in it. And there are some vehicles that you get in and, you know, straight away you just know it's a good vehicle, you know, with a 14-litre Cummins 525 and that. Mm. And it just felt like a proper truck. But again, the world changes. The world changes. It's like the pretty much universal adoption of automated transmissions. I never thought we would get to the level of use that we are now, you know, 15, 20 years ago. But that particular argument now is done and dusted, isn't it, realistically, because of the improvements in technology and software and durability.
Can you even buy a manual gearbox? Or maybe Scania, is that about it?
I think you can get one, you can buy one in an R-Cab Scania, but the numbers have got to be minuscule, really, haven't they? And you know, there are diehards who say that they want to be in control, etc., etc. I think the level of software and the control systems kind of make it, you know, fairly what's the word, a fairly spurious argument nowadays, like, you know. And, you know, in most fleets nowadays, you're looking at clutch life of 600,000, 700,000, even 800,000 Ks in 44-ton tractor units, as long as it's not, there's no other factors that are going to affect it. You would never, across the board, see that level of clutch reliability or clutch life unless you had that one-off really good driver who treated the thing with kid gloves and what have you. And again, I'm a firm believer that you've got to keep sometimes looking back at things, because sometimes we, particularly in modern social media, slight myths get perpetuated about things. And it's like with gearboxes. And this AEC straightforward constant mesh box is not difficult to use, but you've got to be concentrating and concentrating more. And, you know, you're rusty and you haven't done it for years and what have you, and that. You've got to reacquaint yourself with it, but you get better at it as you drive it. And it's like the obsession with some people in social media about the Eaton twin splitter. The Eaton twin splitter was at the back end of kind of constant mesh gearboxes, and more vehicles before that had the range change and splitter pattern full of Road Ranger gearboxes, which came from the same manufacturer. And in some installations, they needed more skill and kind of training or practice to get the best out of them. An Eaton twin splitter was introduced as a more simple version of the gearbox to drive, but it seems now in some people's minds it's the holy grail of driving, isn't it?
Yes, that's right.
You know, and again, I drive if I stop and think about it and what have you, but do I want to be in London in stop-start traffic with a maladjusted clutch brake that every time you try to put it into gear you've got to fight the thing? No, probably don't. You know, like, it's rather like, do you want to go home and listen to a crystal set radio rather than listen to something on the internet? That's just progress. It's life, isn't it? Like, you know.
On the subject of radios, if you'd fitted one in one of these, you'd never have heard it, would you?
I used to have a transistor radio held onto the bonnet with a bungee strap, like, you know. And you'd hear it on the overrun, you know, when the engine was kind of, when you were off the throttle. I suppose my hearing was probably a bit better in those days. It would be there, but like, can you remember the old Motorola type radios where it was fitted with its own speaker and that as well? And like, some of them would mount them on the rear wall, so the speaker was right behind your ear.
Oh, I see.
You know, but also there was less to listen to, I suppose, in those days, wasn't there? We live in a world of nowadays where everything is like excess, isn't it? You know, with the internet and what have you and that. But yeah, people had radios in them, but they weren't, unless you had a really, really powerful output, you couldn't really hear them. And the engine in this AEC, it's not over noisy. It's very noisy by the standards of modern trucks. But compared to something like an Atkinson with a Cummins in it or something like that, this is relatively peaceful. And
And you've got this engine cover as well. I'm pretty sure the Albion didn't even have that, did it?
No. I think it was an option with the Albion. The Albion ergomatic cab was like even more plain. It was utilitarian and just metal engine cover and, you know, kind of minimal sort of soft coverings on anything. I think some Albion cabs as well, in some applications, had lighter gauge metal as well. The main issue with the ergomatic cab is it's a tilt cab, but the actual section around the driver's seat with the controls and the steering column, that doesn't tilt. So as the cab tilts, that is left in place. And as the cab's worn and cab corrosion was a big issue with steel cabs, you'd get a lack of a poor seal around the base of the section around the driver's seat.
Okay.
And that would let a lot of noise in and that as well. And if they got really worn and what have you, maybe workshops didn't put them back together again properly, you could see daylight around the gear lever, which didn't help.
Wow.
But they were a real advance in terms of driving position, vision, control, layout and what have you. And, you know, when in 64 the first ergomatics didn't really go on the road till 65, 66, they were the truck to have. You know, it was, I can remember as a child seeing the first one I ever saw. It was a 1966 one of Hill's Transport in Cardiff. And in the middle of Cardiff at night, and it was deregistration 1966, and that was like the absolute epitome of advanced engineering at its time. But you know, in that 10 years from 66, 67 till when I got my license in 77, everything changed. It changed so fast and kept changing. And, you know, when you have that level of kind of advancement in technology, if you think the kind of modern trucks are amazing in what we can do with them, and, you know, we've got electric drive lines and what have you. But if you think prior to the introduction of the Ergomatic cab, you had an AEC with a coach-built cab that was built by an outside supplier with minimal insulation, and they were still in production by late 60s, 66, because there was an overlap between the old Park Royal, or the old type cabs, and the Ergomatic cabs. And some of the last ones were going into service in 68 and 69. Mm. And by 79 or 78, you could buy an F10 or F12.
Well, yeah, what a difference.
Yeah, you know, with fully suspended cab, air conditioning fitted to standard, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't think you will ever see that huge leap in technology in such a short space of time.
Well, I don't know. We're going through a pretty big one at the moment, aren't we? But I think that's going to be for another podcast, because we've both got some strong views on that one.
Well, exactly. But you know, when you could be driving an AEC Mark V Mandator in a fleet, and your mate had a Volvo F10. That is like a phenomenal Atkinson,
yeah,
isn't it? You know,
yeah,
wooden,
yeah,
cab,
yeah,
frame, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the last of the Atkinson Borders were built 75 into 76. Like, you know, some of them went on the road, and you had like an ash wooden frame, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't think you will ever see that huge variance in technology sharing the same roads, will you? Like,
no, you won't.
You know, but yes.
Brilliant. Well, you can read all about this truck. We're putting, I think it's 8 pages we're putting aside for this one in our Christmas issue that comes out on the 22nd of December. Bob, as always, thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you.
Not much you don't know about trucks, is there?
Oh, it's been a bit of a boring bit, really.
Thanks a lot.
See you soon.